side, because they're nothing to do with us, right? Unless we identify with them. I mean, if the cars go, we don't. We may feel something for the people in the cars, but as far as the cars go, it doesn't bother us. So in the same way we are attached to the body, we identify with the body. So therefore, Krishna is arranged in a mechanical system of mechanical sensual stimulus that therefore creates in our mind, due to our identity, pleasure and pain. You know, happiness, distress, all these different things. Therefore, the differences between the men and the women have to be created by the mechanics of the body, because otherwise the men and women are both spirit-soul. They're both prakriti, both feminine particles of the internal energy. So therefore, you can't create this duality between them, because they're both of the same nature. So to create the experience of, you know, husband and wife, or parent and child, or friends, you have to create that through the mechanics of the body. The bodies are different, and they react differently. This gives the variety. This gives the difference. So, the basic principle we'll look at is how the intelligence functions. And this gives rise to everything else. So, the intelligence functions in a very particular way. Is that in the... We have to mechanically, we go generally, we see through the mechanism of the brain. Right? The brain is like controlling all the physical functions and that. We know behind that there are other forces. Movement is actually controlled by life airs. When the airs expand, they come out. When they contract, our arms will move in. So that's one of the airs. But that air exerts itself on the whole nervous system and all that, and then that creates where the nerve works, and then the muscles work, and then it moves. But it's actually moving because of air. So we see these mechanical functions. So therefore, the intelligence can work without the brain, but it works through the brain. Right? The brain is a, you know, convoluted? I can't remember the technical term for it. It's got some funny name. But the actual, you know, the cells of the brain, so then it's divided into two halves, right? One half of the brain, like the left half of the brain controls the right side of the body, the right side controls the left. And then also in that, there's different things are controlled in the brain in different parts. So in a simplified way, basically one side of the brain works very nicely analytically, and the other side works emotionally, like this. So these two different functions are handled by the two sides of the brain. And so then this is where the difference comes in. Because in the men, then they can function on one side of the brain or the other side, not both at once. So they have to go from one into the other. So this will create the male mentality, where they're either very analytical or highly emotional. But you don't have a blend of both. When they're analytical, they can be very hard-hearted, very cut and dry. And when they're emotional, they don't think at all. You know, they can throw all reason to the wind. So this comes up because of this way the brain works. And then for the ladies, then both sides always work. There's never a time when both sides don't work. So this means that there will always be constantly the analytical aspects going on and the emotional. Therefore, it'll be said that ladies are more emotional and this and that. It's just that they're constantly always a little bit. Not that they are seriously emotional all the time, but constantly some emotion will be there and some analyzing will be going on. So now this creates a difference in how one will function and deal or interact with others, with the material nature, because of this perception. So then in this, then comes into So this gives strengths and weaknesses. So the man's strength is when he is analytical, then he can look at something without any emotion. He can look at it. Here is matter. Here is a situation. Material world is very, difficult situation. And one can cut oneself off from it. Right? Very, very easy. So the strength of the man is in detachment or in being able to distinguish between matter and spirit and choose that spirit with no sentiment towards the matter. It means that is his strength. Of course, it takes training to get to the platform where one can fully take advantage of that. But that is why in the man's light we see that gradual development towards the renounced order. Is because then they can just cut that off, right? And then the whole material existence one can throw to the wind and one doesn't care. But the weakness is if they have sensual attraction, then they don't think. They will give up anything, do anything for the senses. And this is the greatest weakness. So we see in the Bhagavatam, this element is then addressed also in two chapters. Oh, excuse me. Before we get to this, let us look at the other side, at the woman's side. So then, for the women, then because both sides always work, this also gives an advantage and a disadvantage. Advantage is that even in an emotional environment, one is able to think. One is able to consider what to do, what not to do. Therefore, you see when affairs, especially of the house, the wife can think, okay, this should be done, that should be done. You know, people are coming over, we have to make these arrangements. So many people, so some people will sit here, some will sit there. All these things they can make very, very well. You know, the emotions are there, some friends, some relatives, some guests are coming, so that natural mood of affection is there. At the same time, one can analyze what to do. Other advantages, let's say in the area of the children. When you have a small baby, then they make all kinds of funny noises and point and do all kinds of weird faces and all that. So naturally, you have to know what they're thinking about, what they want. So this means, and to want to know what they're doing, you have to have some affection. There must be some emotion. So the emotional side's there, so there's attraction to help the baby. At the same time, the analytical side is there, you can figure out what they need. Right? You see, the men can't do this at all. It's either the baby starts crying, and it's kind of like they want to get rid of the baby, tell the wife, your kid is crying. Or they'll want to help, but they can't figure out what's going on, and the women have to come along and say, I'll take care of it. You know, they can't function. So this is the strengths, is that in this platform, then they can be strong. Weakness comes is that when it comes to the analyzation between matter and spirit, then the woman can very easily see it with training, that here is matter, here is spirit. And know that, okay, spirit is the important element, matter is not. But now when it comes to practically applying that, yes, I will take the spirit, leave the matter, the weakness comes in here is that the emotional aspects that are connected with the matter. Someone may feel bad if we don't do this, or so many things. It's just like you want to say goodbye to Maya, there is no pleasant way. There is no nice way you can just say goodbye to Maya, you know, material existence. Krishna, his recommendation is Gita, is with the sword of knowledge you cut yourself free. So it just has to be a clean cut. So that is the difficulty for the women, because they are accustomed to an atmosphere of always pleasant, sweet, soft, like that. So even when you want to pull out, you want to leave some of the affairs of the house or do different things, it's very hard to do that without becoming hard-hearted oneself. So this weakness is there. So now the whole concept with the Vedic idea of marriage, then this complements both. This aspect of where the weaknesses are is complemented by the strength of the other party. So it works like this. When the man is weak, means if he gets attracted by the senses, then he's on the emotional platform. So the wife can identify with that emotional platform, but she still is able to analyze that this is not a proper situation. So then she can inform the husband, this is not good. This is not according to religious principles. So therefore, the wife is mentioned in the Bhagavatam that the wife is like the fortress for the senses of the husband. She is able to keep his senses in control. So then, by that, then he is saved. And then she can bring him back to understanding, thinking according to the philosophy rather than thinking according to the senses. And because of this ability, the wife is called the Dharma Patni, or the religious wife, because she maintains the religious principles. She sees to it that the house is guided by religious principles and not by sense gratification. This is her duty in the house. Right? And then on the other side, then the weakness of the wife when it comes to discriminating between matter and spirit and making that decision and effectively, practically applying it, it's that sometimes a weakness can be there. It's not strong enough because you have the battle between the emotions and the analytical ability. So, because the man, if he is properly trained, he can be situated in that analytical side. Then he can try to give support to the analytical side of the wife. And between the combination of the both of his analytical ability and hers, overpower her emotions, her sentiment. And in this way, then a very nice Krishna conscious decision can be made. Right? Krishna conscious activity. So because one can do that, then the husband is called the Guru Pati. Or Prabhupada used the word, I can't remember it, but basically it means the husband guru, that he is able to guide the wife when it comes to these philosophical matters. So this blend between the strengths of being able to apply the philosophy in the life and the strength of being able to apply religious principles in the life, this combination then is what makes the Grihastha Ashram very strong and very valuable for those members who follow this path. So this is the functions that are there. So if one follows that, then it works very, very nicely. The house is very peaceful. Everything is based on philosophical and religious nature. And everything works very, very nicely. So this is also, of course, dependent that the boys and girls are trained. That the men and women are trained so that they can function with this. The men are strong enough, they've been trained nicely as brahmacharis, then they're able to control the senses. And the girls have been trained nicely in chastity, religious principles, the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, then they are able to practice properly. Therefore, in the Vedic culture, there would always be this separation between men and women so that they can develop properly. Especially in the young age, during the student time, between the time of they're not married. Therefore, the strict separation is there so that the boys can become strong in controlling the senses, the philosophy, and active service to the Lord. And the girls can become very strong in learning all the different aspects of their religious principles, learning very nicely how to apply that in the philosophy, and to be very chaste. Then it becomes very strong. Then the marriage of such a boy and girl is successful. It works very nicely. And So now if we don't have this, then we can look at, so this has been the positive presentation. It means what is the ideal. Now, if we don't have this, then we run into some other problems. If the men aren't trained properly, prematurely they get married, either due to their own weakness or due to being attracted by the ladies, then we find without the training, they will not be strong enough to remain, control the senses and remain in the analytical platform. So the tendency will be whenever they're with the wife, they will be on the emotional side. And then we fall down into sense gratification, because that is the interest. The senses can't be controlled. Then the weakness in the ladies, if they're not trained in this to balance, where we see, so the main training, so the girl, boys, they're trained in that how do you say, in the brahmacharya, the girls in the chastity, that they keep their mind in one place. Then what can come up is what the Bhagavatam discusses instead of the Dharma Patni, then other chapters discuss, like Urvasi points out, that it is the nature of the tigress. Like that. We see that, yeah. So there it describes the tigress. So the tigress means that there is the mood of, instead of being situated on the platform of the emotions are being used to how to take care of others. The emotions are, you know, soft to take care and help and be part of, you know, a very nice cooperative spirit. Then if the emotions are toned down, then the heart becomes hard. And when the heart becomes hard, then the girl will be interested just in her own senses. Like we see, to be a mother, you have to give up your own interest in sense gratification. Prabhupada said the closest thing we get to actual love in the material world is the affection of the mother for the child. Because a mother, you know, especially like the first 2 years when the child is, after the child is born, then there's generally not a single night goes by where there's not some disturbance in the sleep. So sleeping, when they eat, when they'll do different things, because the child has to be taken care of. And when the child wants to eat or sleep or this, you have to take care. So much sacrifice is there. So if one is not willing to sacrifice like that, then the heart becomes hard and we are fixed in our own idea of our own senses. Therefore, we see nowadays it's very difficult. Modern mothers have problems taking care of children because the children are always crying and wanting to eat and wanting to sleep right when they have other more important things they'd rather be doing. And because of this, then the child doesn't get the proper attention they need and they develop all kinds of strange mental, you know, disturbances, so much emotional disturbances, which then disturbs the mother more. She becomes more upset. And like this, it just goes on. So the whole idea of the Vedic culture was is the girls would be protected. Because when one is protected, naturally one is more soft. If one has to take care of oneself, one has to become a little tough to deal in the material nature outside the house. One has to. One has to be able to go get a job, say that you're great. Others come up to you and bother you. You have to be able to deal with that, you know. So one has to be able to be quite strong and rough. And this can sometimes have, unless there's a very strong purpose doing this for children or something, where one can balance it with that strong, caring mood or giving shelter to someone else, then it can make the heart very hard. So in the Vedic culture, then the women, by being protected very nicely, then all these nice, gentle qualities could flourish. And with those qualities, then they could train the children very, very nicely. Through that gentleness, through that caring mood, they could influence the children to make them also very religious, philosophically minded, you know, proper behavior, proper morals, proper attitudes. They could do this. Because you can only influence somebody to do something you yourself have. What you have, you can give to someone else. What you don't have, you can't give. So when one has these things, then the children grow up very nice. And then the next generation, you have very good quality of children. See, Arjuna was immediately worried. in the Gita about Varna Shankara, because he said the women will be polluted, therefore they'll become hard-hearted, and they won't train the children. So the whole society will just be finished. Like that. So that was his worry, his anxiety. So that is a natural anxiety in the culture, because we see that this is how things should properly function. So the whole idea in the Vedic culture is one protects the girls so that they don't become tigresses. They become very first-class mothers. And the boys, as students, they're protected so that they can learn to control the senses, be able to develop their analytical abilities, their thinking powers on philosophy and that, so they can apply it in their life to become strong Krishna conscious, either brahmacharis or grihasthas. Therefore, Prabhupada says first-class brahmachari makes a first-class grihastha. Because then, as a grihastha, he will be able to control his senses and see that the situation is guided in a nice Krishna conscious way. Right? That's why Prabhupada uses the term grihastha brahmachari. Practically, he's a brahmachari. Unless he wants to have children, he won't approach the wife. Like that. So, like that. That means you have two children, then we've approached the wife twice. So in a whole life, twice you approach your wife, why that will not be called brahmachari? Right? So, like that. And also then this is according to religious principles. So then it works very nicely. If it's not according to religious principles, of course, then we can't call it brahmachari. But if it's according to religious principles, then it's not a problem. So now, in the training of the brahmacharis and the girls, then we have Prabhupada gives another detail we mentioned it, I think, the other day, is that the boys are trained in brahmacharya and how to be sensitive to the needs of the wife, the needs of the daughters or the mothers, in other words, the needs of what the women require. Then he will know that he cannot be selfish. Maybe he's looking at things in an analytical way, but he always has to remember that others have needs. They may not be thinking in the same way. So he must be sensitive to see that those needs are addressed and worked out in a proper fashion. Then that creates that takes the edge off the sharpness on the man's analytical side. And by the brahmacharya, that also tempers that one understands that the emotional side being fixed there is also very weak. And one can very easily attach to material nature and not develop proper Krishna consciousness. And on the girl, she's trained in chastity, so the mind is fixed in one place. And that And she's also trained to be satisfied with whatever the father, the husband, or the son provides. Because if one is satisfied, then there's peace. Right? Opulence in the house comes when there's peace in the house. If there's no peace, it doesn't matter how much you have, there's actually no opulence. Because what's the use of opulence that you cannot use? Right? Like if I'm out in the middle of an island somewhere alone, right? You know, like typical, like you see in the comic books, little island about as big as what I'm sitting on with one coconut tree. And I have a chest full of gold. But it has no meaning, no use. I can't use it. So one may have unlimited opulence in the house, but unless there's peace, no one can take advantage of it. So if there's peace in the house, even if one lives very simply, then there is great satisfaction. Because satisfaction is there on the emotional platform. The whole concept of getting married, the idea is there must be some, emotional support and satisfaction. And then from that, one can then transfer one's attachments from the form of the material world into the form of the spiritual world, means attachment to Krishna. like that. We can see that the material nature, these material attachments to emotions and senses, is not the actual platform, but the real platform is with Krishna. So one has to be able to transfer. So one is so disturbed on the material platform, and at the same time so attached, then it's a difficulty. Naturally, if one follows in the Krishna conscious way, then because we are dealing with matter, we will not be satisfied. So one doesn't have to worry that, well, what if it works so perfectly, then we'll be so absorbed, then we will be so satisfied, we'll never want to go back to Godhead. It won't happen. Because there's always a problem with the material nature. It just doesn't give the satisfaction, because it's dead matter. How long can you go on talking to someone who never looks at you and never reciprocates back? After a while, you know, you adjust. You know, unless you're crazy, then maybe you have your pet cat, and when it dies, then you take it to the taxidermist and have it stuffed. And then you can come home and pet it every day and say, yes, this is the best cat in the world and everything. But that is accepted that one is, you know, clinically mad. But otherwise, one, there's always a natural disturbance. Everything's temporary. It runs out. It changes. You know, situations change. People die. People go away. You know, our reactions to our previous activities change. Krishna's mercy is having its effect. So we will always find that we are not satisfied. Even though everything goes perfectly, we still aren't satisfied. One nice example is Devahuti and Kardama. If you look at it in the Bhagavatam, it's a perfect marriage. No problems. You don't hear of one problem, right? Like you see with Diti and Kasyapa, there's some problem there, right? But we don't see anything in Devahuti and Kardama, right? So everything's running perfectly, nicely, living very peacefully. They have first-class children, and the best of this is Kapila Muni, you know, the Supreme Lord himself. So everything's very nice. But as soon as Kapila Muni told his father, now I will train my mother in Krishna consciousness, then the Kardama then felt, now I have finished my duties, and now I can go to the forest. He didn't wait a moment more. Right? Even so, everything is so perfect, then when the opportunity comes, then one can leave very easily. Like that. And we see marriages that don't work. The emotional state is so disturbed, then we see marriage after marriage after marriage. Even we've approached the time when it's time for detachment or retirement, still we're getting married again. So this means this is a long commitment. You know, this is a long term. So it's all very, very important, the training. The training. So either we are trained before we get married, or if we find that we're married, we don't have the training, then we must learn. We must study. We must take advice from others who are able to run marriages properly or have. They have now, graduated to the next platform. They are vanaprastas. They've had successful marriages. They can tell you how to do them. Or someone who has successfully come to vanaprastha, even if marriage didn't work nicely, they can tell you what not to do. You know, in some way we must educate ourselves. You know, by reading, by association. You know, we must take advantage and learn what it is, how to run it. Because then the whole thing will run very, very nicely and very, very pleasantly. We will not be disturbed. Right? Yes. Question is there a difference between the mind and the brain? See, the brain is a function that we do so many things with. All the senses work through the brain. So that means the senses are then connected to the mind. So the mind has to work through there also. Like that. That's just the mechanism through which it works. Ultimately, it's all coming from the heart. The mind, intelligence, false ego are situated in the heart with the soul. That's why when you removed Daksha's head and put a goat's head there, then he could still function. Because the mind, intelligence, and ego are in the heart. Though now he had to do all this work through the functioning of a goat's brain, but he could still work because he has a human, you know, identity, you know, the human mind and the human intelligence. Though he had to work through the mechanism of a goat's head, like that. But it still worked, like that. You know, it means you want to get to, you want to drive from one place to another. You can do it in a Mercedes or you can do it in a Polsky Fiat. You know, you'll get there. But it's just a matter of how, you know, to what advantage or not, how comfortable it will be. So it's still functioning. Like this. Yes. Uh-huh. Question is, how is it Diti became overwhelmed by emotions and couldn't think rationally? See, this is the point. This is the weakness, as we mentioned, that the women will experience. Is her co-wife, Aditi, who is her sister, already had children. So then she was feeling that she didn't have children, she wanted to have children. Because then it's more of a prestige. You know, she has her child and this and that. And, you know, having a child means that there's more maturity, more responsibility, more knowledge, you know. So these aspects are, you know, it's a greater sense of importance. So because of that, then she wasn't analyzing the situation. She wants a child, that's fine. She as the wife of her husband, she can naturally approach him and mention her desire. Then, according to religious principles, they can work out what kind of child they want, means according, and pick a suitable time, and then try for a child. But that side was not there. She was too impatient because of her emotions. She let them get away, get stronger. So then she approaches the husband. And, you know, which is at the wrong time and in the wrong attitude, you know. Means her whole approach was to get for prestige. She wasn't thinking that it's, you know, we have to expand, we're Prajapatis, it's our business to expand the universe, so this is our duty. And so we have to find suitable time, place, circumstance for performance of duty. And, you know, this is what we're supposed to do. But it was simply that, you know, Aditi has children, I don't. I want children. So she approached at the wrong time, and then Kasyapa then mentioned that this is not good. It's a wrong time. It's at the twilight, right? The essential element of the twilight is 24 minutes, like that. And the whole Muhurta is about 48 minutes. So basically he was asking her to wait for whatever time was left in that 48 minutes, or 24, depending upon what he was calculating. It means you can either put 48 minutes exactly on the middle of the sunset and 24 before, 24 after, as the sandhya, or you can say the influence of Shiva until it's completely is 48 minutes after. So one of those. He wasn't asking for a long time. He didn't say come back after 3 years. He simply said, can you wait 24 minutes? So her basic reply was no. You know, because that means 24 minutes later, the child will be born. You know, and she wasn't about to wait for that. She couldn't wait 10 months and 24 minutes. She had to; it had to be right then at that time. So then, now if he had been strong, see the problem is he wasn't a devotee. He's an impersonalist. So therefore, his sense, he was not as controlled as he could have been. Otherwise, he would have just told her, forget it. You know, we're going to wait until the time is over and you're going to calm down and be in the right consciousness and then we will have a child. But instead, because he doesn't have anything to fix his consciousness on except the impersonal Brahman, therefore, when you have activity, that will be more attractive to the mind than inactivity of the Brahman. So his mind is swayed. And then instead of being the Gurupati and telling her no, he agreed. Right? So therefore, then they got the result. Right? From the wife's influence, the child was very interested in prestige, position, and sense gratification. And prestige and position. And from the husband's side, interested in sense gratification. Right? The wife wasn't interested in sense gratification. She just was interested in prestige. She wanted a kid. And there's a mechanical system to get it, and she wanted it to happen now. And he was attracted by the beauty of the wife and all these things, by the senses, so he agreed. So then we ended up with Hiranyakashipu, whose total aim in life is how to become the controller and enjoyer of the whole universe. Right? So you can see there was definitely great determination there. Right? You have to hand it to Diti for having such fixed, resolute determination and Kasyapa that they could create such a demoniac mentality. Right? I mean, even today, we can't create such. No one has that great determination. There are sense gratified guys, but not that much. You know? So that is the fault there. That is the weakness. So it is something also to be learned. Yeah. Okay. Does that make sense? We have to learn from these things that they have their application here, but they have everything in the Bhagavatam has its application in all different realms of the philosophy and application. So here's a practical just between man and wife. Right? Another practical application is what Krishna mentions in the Gita, if the mind of even a very detached person fixes on any one sense object, then it can be carried away, like a boat is carried away in a storm. Because they're determined to come to the point where one has very few desires and is detached takes great determination. The mind must be very, very strong. Right? Now, if it is fixed in detachment, that's okay. But if it becomes fixed in sense gratification, it's also going to go that road very far before you figure out this is wrong. Right? Immediately afterwards, Diti understood it was wrong, Kasyapa understood it was wrong, because they were very detached. But they allowed their mind to become fixed on this. Therefore, with this understanding, the devotees are very broad-minded. Rather than how could someone who is advanced in spiritual life get involved in some meager aspect of sense gratification? And then just say, well, they're the same as us then. I'm interested in sense gratification. And I see they've done something in sense gratification. Therefore, we're same. So therefore, they were never anything special. Therefore, I've been cheated. Therefore, you know, nobody can advance. If they can't advance, we can't advance. And also, why should we trust anybody? Because any senior person, it may just be a show. Right? But here is the example. You take the philosophy that Krishna gives in the Gita and the example that's given in the Bhagavatam. This is the proper combination of philosophy and religion. Then you see, yes, they can get into trouble because they're more qualified. Therefore, there has to be very nicely this system of shelter of devotees. The shelter must be there. The senior devotees have to be able to protect. The brahmacharis, if they're not trained, they can't protect the wife. And if the girl's not trained, she can't protect the husband. She never should have approached him. She should have come to him and said, Aditya has a child, why don't I have a child? And then he says, this is not the proper religious time to have a child. And then she should have said, yes, you're right. You know? So what is the proper time? But instead, she just pushed on, you know, doing all her crying and all her feminine moves and this and that till she broke down his intelligence. right? And he wasn't strong enough to just say, you know, come back later, you know, or get up and just walk out of the room. He became attracted. So now they're only in that position. Look at, well, we have to know, understand the position of Prajapatis. Prajapatis are above the platform of Indra. Indra is totally interested in sense gratification, but from the platform of goodness, right? The girls he associates with must be pure vegetarian, must eat only ghee, they must follow the Vedic culture, you know, sing and dance according to the Vedic version, you know, act like, actually like women and not like some other variety of 8,400,000. So, like that, then he's interested, but he's totally into sense gratification, right? Totally into control. But the Prajapati, so that means anyone who is interested in sex life as something that you're going to get some buzz out of, they are situated in the universe from Indra on down. But, and those who are not interested in sense gratification, like that, they do things, you know, purely out of duty and not for the purpose of a karmic result. You know, it has to be more towards jnana. Then they are from the heavenly planets above, I mean the planets above Indra up. That means jnana, tapa, satya, and mahar. So the Prajapatis are situated on the first planet above Indra. I don't remember if that's mahar or jnana. Anyone knows? The next one up, huh? Mahar. So Mahar Loka, that's where all the Prajapatis live. So for them, their duty is to populate the universe. And to do that, then there must be sex. So sex is just part of the occupational hazard of producing, populating the universe. So for them, that's not the important element. But there's still that some attachment. Therefore, they're in that position. Because above that, you see it's only brahmacharis and that. There's no... They don't get involved in these things so much. Is that understood? So therefore, we can see that they are very elevated. They're basically more than the main demigods, because they all have their wives do so many different things and this and that. But they are very elevated. So they are living as sadhus, we see in our picture. They're living as Brahmins in the forest with nothing in a grass hut, doing their yajnas and all this. And they're all highly qualified. So therefore, from this example, we can understand that it doesn't matter who you are, if you fix your mind on the senses, allow it to become fixed there, you know, and go beyond thinking. So it goes into feeling, into willing. Then this problem. But the difference is because of being fixed on that platform, very easily they can come back if there's the proper support. Like we see Lord Brahma. He is doing all the creation. You can imagine how much concentration it has to be there because he's doing it all from his mind. So he's totally absorbed in creating the different aspects, the different elements. So he has to be totally absorbed in every aspect of it. The mood, the form, the activities, the qualities. He has to be totally absorbed. So then when he creates that one mental daughter, he has to be totally absorbed in that mood. But he allowed his mind to become attached. And he's running after that daughter. Right? And then the four Kumaras and Narad Muni and the others, they didn't go, well, look at this nonsense, you know? You know, he's got four heads, but he's still so stupid, he's running after this girl. You know? And all this time, you know, I thought he was an elevated person and all that. Now we find out he's just, you know, just a common sense gratifier. No, they went up to him and said, my dear sir, don't mind, but, you know, you're Lord Brahma and your position is to, you know, manage things in the universe, create things in that. Your business is not running after daughters. You know, one, it's against religious principles. And two, you know, it's not your position. That's for other lowly creatures. And then Lord Brahma, then with that analytical input, it switched his mind back. And then he said, yes, you're right. And then he gave that up. And we've never heard of him doing such things again. Right? But we can't think, well, no, once he did that, maybe he'll do again. How we can trust, you know, maybe it'll happen again in the future. You know, those are all the thinkings of someone who is not very mature or advanced, who does not understand actually what is the mind, what is determination, what are these things. So therefore, one has to be able to balance. That is a Vaishnava. Vaishnava is perfectly balanced. And if one's not a devotee, then one has a tendency to be unbalanced, either too soft or too hard. Right? As we mentioned, if the brahmacharya is not trained, he'll either be too hard, you know, he'll be so analytical he doesn't care for others, or he'll be so soft he can't properly think. Like that. So this is the importance in the Vedic culture of the training. Does that make sense? Yes.
What kind of a man can get rid of weakness of man without being married?
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, okay. This goes back. It can explain nicely. question is what kind of man can overcome these weaknesses of the man without having to go through marriage? So that platform is called the Naistika Brahmachari. So one has to come to the platform of realization. One has to hear the philosophy, contemplate the philosophy, and able to realize it. Means he himself can fix himself on that analytical platform and is able to look at everything through that vision. That's called Shastra Chakshus. Always can see through that vision. And then with time, that vision will mature into full Krishna consciousness. It won't just be intellectual, it'll actually be coming from the heart. The realizations will deepen. So this means that one has to have very strong qualities, means to become fixed. In other words, this means one is very fixed. So to be fixed, then the qualities are given in the third shloka of the Shikshastaka. You know, Trinadapi Sunichena, Tarorapi Sahishnuna, Amanina Mana Dena Kirtani Sadahari. So that means one must be very humble. Because a brahmachari is always a menial servant. They always have to have that attitude. Even if they're doing some big service, that is their service to others. Even if I have to manage a whole temple or country or something. But that is my service to the others. I am everybody else's servant. Like that. So I have the ability to manage or to organize or do something. I do that for everybody. You know, that's what I can do for the devotees. So one always has to be very humble. Tolerant, one must be able to tolerate things, because if one can't tolerate, that's generally a symptom of material desire, the desire to control, because it's not going the way you want, therefore you can't stand that. So one has to have that tolerance to accept that things are going to go how Krishna wants them to go. I do my best, it goes that way, nice, it doesn't go that way, then what can we do? We just see what is Krishna's plan. So one has to be tolerant. One has to be broad-minded. If you only see things according to your needs, okay, as a strict brahmachari, then anybody else who's not a strict brahmachari is a write-off. Then that person will have very great difficulty remaining brahmachari, because he only sees to his vision, because that's not Shastra Chakshus. Shastra gives opening for everybody. Krishna is very broad-minded. The acharyas are very broad-minded. So someone who can remain brahmachari is also broad-minded. He has no problem if all his friends get married. If that's what they need, that's fine. He can support that. He can be happy knowing that they are living happily with their wife. He can be happy that they've married, you know, the most beautiful girls in the temple. It doesn't bother him. He's happy when they have children. He's happy to see that, you know, economically developing, and they're satisfied and they're doing nice service for Krishna. He may be unhappy if in doing that they become less Krishna conscious. But that doesn't bother him that they get into that, because that's their path. Right? Just like someone serving prasadam. And there's so many varieties, and you take more of one and your friend takes more of another. You don't feel bad. You don't think, well, I can only enjoy this if he also takes. Right? Because if he takes something else, may mean that what I'm doing is not as good. Why did he pick that? You know, I don't want this. Give me what he's taking. You know? Or the other is that, that's terrible. Don't take that. Only an idiot would eat that. You got to eat this. You know? In other words, everybody has their need and their taste. Somebody eats a lot, somebody eats little. What do you care? So that is balance there. Then, amanina mana dana, is that even one has qualities, one deserves respect, either as a devotee, he is a long term, we've been brahmachari the last 20 years, you know, you are the senior most in the temple, or whatever it is, and somebody doesn't deal with you on that platform, they may insult or not deal according to the position, you don't become upset. Because we're just menial servants. Like that. It's Krishna's service. If I'm to be respected, I am. If I'm not, I'm not. If people respect and they're in a junior position, it's good for them. Because they learn the proper understanding of the parampara. Right? But if they don't respect, then the parampara aspect is broken, they'll never have great. So we may explain to them. But not for ourselves, for others. And if it's a delicate situation, better let someone else take care of it. Why will say anything? What do we care? So with this, we can become fixed. That third shloka is the definition of being fixed. Then kirtaniya sadahari. Then you can always chant, always absorb yourself in Krishna consciousness. Then why one has to go through this stage of anartha nivritti on this social platform? Right? You understand?
Also a question. How can such a man be a menial servant if he, for example, he don't feel himself protected? How you mentioned this.
Oh, if he doesn't, how if he doesn't, how does one feel a menial servant if he doesn't feel protected? Because for especially in this case, brahmacharis and sannyasis, vanaprastas, they have to start seeing that it's Krishna who's protecting. So even though we may feel maybe, you know, the temple commander, the temple president, or, you know, the grihastas or the women or whatever, they don't protect the brahmacharis. They bother them, harass them, say, why don't you get married, or, you know, whatever it is they say. But but Krishna will take care. Krishna will take care. Or one he discusses with whatever authorities can correct this situation. But this starts to get down into practical management. You know? Like that. But the mood is there is that, you know, Krishna is my protector. Right? Like that. We see that Prabhupada, when one depends upon Krishna. When Prabhupada was in New York, then he was up on the upper east side. Upper west side, I think. Then with the uptown Swami. Then somebody decided that they wanted to check this sannyasi, because everybody else has come from India. They say they're detached, renounced, but they're not. So then they arranged that, you know, some lady had come who's very famous for her abilities in getting the sannyasis to not maintain their vows, had come to a program that evening. And then, you know, Prabhupada was there and this, and they were all in one room and all that. And then at a set time, everybody in the room kind of just, you know, for some reason or another got up and left. So all that was left was Prabhupada and this lady in the room. And then Prabhupada said that in that situation, then he could understand what was going on, and he immediately started praying to Krishna to protect him. You know? And then like that, I don't know if he left the room or someone else just came in, whatever it was, but somehow or another, then Krishna protected Prabhupada. And like that. And then the people who had arranged the whole thing were then very impressed, because all the other swamis, they were, you know, they found it a very good offer, you know, like that. So that aspect is there. But of course, that's one of the ideas of all this discussion, is that we understand why all the different aspects of the varnashram are necessary. Any grihastha who just harasses brahmacharis to get married, or any women who do that, means they don't understand varnashram. So a woman can get a man by using so many varieties of tricks, by playing to the senses or to the emotions or something. One can catch, you know, especially if one is not so well trained. But the problem is then you get an inferior quality, inferior commodity. It means you get a husband that's actually useless. So basically anything you can attract by the senses then will be useless. Because when it comes to the crunch, then like Kasyapa, then he's not going to be able to hold up. He's not going to be able to say this is wrong. And then you end up with, you know, little miniature Hiranyakashipus as children. You know? So like that. I mean, it's there. Bhagavatam is very, very practical. We may think, well, Bhagavatam's the philosophy, but that's yes, it is philosophy. It is paravidya. But the point is it's paravidya in the format of Purana. Puranas are written so you have the practical example of how things work, how to apply the philosophy in your life. That's why in Kali Yuga, the Purana, as the fifth Veda, means it's philosophy in action. Right? Example is there. It's more important in this age than the Vedic literature themselves, the actual Vedic mantras. Because the Bhagavatam shows how those who follow the transcendental philosophy apply it in their life. And how if they apply in the right way, they get a good result. They apply it in the wrong way, they get a bad result. You understand? We Dhruva Maharaj and his mother applied it in the right way, they both went back to Godhead. Diti and Kasyapa did it in the wrong way, they got a bad result. So like that, you can see that the Bhagavatam is complete in its example and explanation of the culture. Right? But one has to study and look at it from that side. Not that, oh, you know, this is the one thing, and then to raise kids, and we got to go to Dr. Spock or something. You know? Only if you have pointed ears, then you know how to raise children. Right? One may take some practical pointers, like that, but one has to understand that if those pointers don't agree with the philosophy or the principles given in Bhagavatam, it won't work. Because even Dr. Spock himself, at the end of his life, said, actually, I was wrong. Right? He had a concept, he worked towards it, but after however many years it was, he understood it didn't work as well as he thought. Like that. Huh? Okay? Yeah, we'll get back to you. Mataji? Okay. The two questions. One is on how do we put together reconciliate the aspects of attachment to the body, and then Prabhupada mentions that if we get sick we have to take care of the body. And the second one is how to
compassion.
Yeah, compassion and sentimentality. So the first one is that if we want to do any service, practical, active service in the material world, we have this material body. So as long as it's important we do that service, then we must maintain the body. Right? As long as we see that the body can do service, we maintain it. But we don't unnecessarily spend too much time on it. It means if we go through all the motions that should maintain the body, but we find that the body still doesn't maintain itself, then we can understand that, you know, that's the way it is. These are called, either Krishna has some arrangement, something to teach us, or this is called what's called karma vyadis. Karma vyadis means diseases due to very heavy karma that they won't go away. It means because when you take medicine, it will make the disease go away. It means let's say we're supposed to have a cold for 10 days. So now that's the reaction, is 10 days of cold. So if after 2 days we take some medicine, make it go away, we have 8 days left. So at another time then the cold will come up, then we'll have it for 1 day, take medicine, go away, we have 7 days left. Then another time we get a cold and we can't get medicine for 3 days, then like this. Until 10 days are up, then we find we won't get colds anymore. Like that. So if the reaction is so strong, then even we take the medicine, we will find it won't go away because all that you have to go through all that, right? So the scriptures recommend also when one nears the end of life, one doesn't depend so much on medicines. One takes a reaction. Maybe when we're young, we'll get rid of it. We can do so much service, purify ourselves. But as we get older, we may find that we let things go a little bit, because other, we don't want it to carry over to the next life. Means idea is that if we're more advanced, can we kind of ignore the diseases in that? Point is if you can continue your service without, you know, disturbing it, then one can let these, you know, things go on. One can have some of the diseases affect us or this or that and not worry about it. But if they affect our service, it's much better to perform positive service than just to receive the reactions of sinful activities. You understand? Means devotional service is much more purifying than the effect of reactions, right? So unless there's some lesson we're not learning, then we'll generally see that things may go nicely. But if there's some lesson to learn, Krishna may not also let that go nicely. Because when we're very healthy, the tendency is to be very proud. Senses become very strong. We become attracted by by senses. We think we're very expert. We develop the mood of controller, enjoyer. So sometimes Krishna may put us through some of these things just to break that mood, to show that when he wants, it'll go that way. Like Arjuna, he was so qualified, right? He was a Maharati. That means he can fight with 1,000 people. That means 1,000 qualified people, not just bozos. You know? And very, very powerful. He has divine weapons, right? Not very many Kshatriyas had divine weapons. He has weapons from the demigods, right? So then... And he's fighting on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, and when we think of the hero at Kurukshetra, we think of Arjuna. So now we have a scenario later where no warriors. All he has to do is get 16,108 women from point A to point B, right? And then while he's going through some passageway, you know, some area, then from over the grassy hills comes a bunch of cowherd boys with their sticks, right? They're not trained in fighting or anything. They just have their stick, keep away cows, maybe, you know, whack a dog on the nose or something. And they come along and walk off with all these girls. And Arjuna can do nothing. So then when he gets back to Hastinapur and they ask him how everything's going, then he can understand that it was Krishna's ability that he could do what he was doing. And when Krishna removed that ability, he couldn't even fight with just some common cowherd boys. Right? You know, let alone Kshatriya, this just some cowherd boy, he couldn't fight. You know, he's got all his astras, weapons, chariot, horses, everything. He can do nothing against some guys just come up, take the girls and say, see you later. You know, and they go. So, like that, Krishna may sometimes, to cut our ego, give those diseases and allow them to, even though we're taking medicines, they don't go away. Because it's something he wants to either purify us from, or some mentality he wants to correct. You know? Like that. Something is there. Some misgiving is in the heart of some degree. And he wants to remove that. Like that. Whether it's gross, subtle, whatever. But he wants to remove that. The other aspect. Compassion and sentiment. So we have... the whole point is the compassion must be connected to the philosophy. Right? Prabhupada says... religion without philosophy is sentiment. So if that compassion was there, Arjuna had compassion on the warriors on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. He had compassion upon the family members back in the palace that would be affected. But because he wasn't connecting it to the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, that this was his service to Krishna, to help Krishna rid the earth of all the what is it? Pritranaya sadhunam. Vinashanaya duskritam, to destroy Vinashana, to destroy the unruly element. He was supposed to help Krishna in that. Krishna likes to do things with his devotees, so Krishna also has to remove the bad element. So he doesn't want to do it alone. He can, as a universal form, he's already killed them all. But he wants pastime, interaction between him and his devotees. So therefore, for 18 days with Arjuna, then they do that. So Arjuna wasn't connecting his compassion with the philosophy. Therefore it was sentiment. And Krishna called him a fool. So that's the whole idea in this element. If the wife becomes too emotional, too compassionate, or whatever it may be, the husband has to bring in the philosophy. And then like that they have to match it up. Both of them understand everything very nicely. And then carry on. Like that. Yes. How does it happen? The question is, how does the man become compassionate and all that? Because we've mentioned how the brain works. Basically, it is by understanding the philosophy, by purification. It means that you see through the eyes of Shastra. You start to see everyone as Krishna's servant. Because as we ourselves see ourselves as Krishna's servant, we naturally take on the transcendental qualities, feminine qualities of Prakriti. And in that, Radharani, she is the personification of Krishna's compassion. So as we develop more and more the identity that I am Krishna's servant, those feminine qualities, the real feminine qualities, actually manifest. You know? So on the material platform, one may have the masculine material qualities or feminine material qualities, but idea is those have to be purified to come to the platform of transcendental feminine qualities. So the man and the woman are both trying to come to that same platform of transcendental feminine qualities. Like that. Because Krishna, only Krishna, is the male. Like that. Problem is both the men and women in the material world think that they're men. Because men means we are the enjoyer. So the woman is trying to enjoy the man and the facilities the man gives, and the man is trying to enjoy the woman and all the, you know, different pleasantries and atmosphere that's created by the woman. So both are actually men. So what you have is two females who come into the material world, they think they're males, one of them's in a female body, one's in a male body, and this way they go about their mutual consent of exploitation. So that is factually, if you look at just the pure tattva, That's what's going on in the material world, you know? So this is what we're trying to overcome. Therefore, we work with it in the conditioned state, but ultimately we know the whole thing's just has to, it's an illusion that one is the husband, one is the wife. They're both just servants of Krishna, right? But the conditioned nature must be dealt with. That's essential. Does that make some sense? Okay. Yes.
In Kali Yuga, women are like men, and men are like women.
Yes.
And we see, therefore, many, many examples of unchaste women. Does it mean, in order to be chaste, she has to have very strong husband, or it's just a question of training that women should have some training to be chaste?
Okay. Question is in, we see in the Kali Yuga, you know, especially in modern times, the men are like women, the women are like men. And so, for such a woman, how to become chaste and develop the proper mentality? So does that mean she has to have a very strong man to do that, or what is the situation? So basically, it's just like a child. I'll give an example. Oh no. Maybe too strong. We see, okay, we'll take it like in a classroom environment. You have a not so well trained teacher and a very good trained teacher. So you may have, because the teacher is not so well trained, the students are quite wild. Then, so this will go on. But then if you bring that qualified teacher into the room, you'll see the children will just automatically behave. They just figure it out. They can just see and just, we don't mess with this person. So that element of men being trained, I mean, if the men are trained, then even a girl who's very wild can be contained. You know, at least in theory. We have, even in the Western concept, you have in Shakespeare, there's a play called The Taming of the Shrew. And in there you had a exceedingly wild, puffed up girl. And she was then controlled by, you know, a very confident and qualified man. He just took whatever she did and turned it back on herself until she became sick of it. And just became nice, like that. You know, she was crazy, he was more crazy. And like that, until she got tired of craziness and just wanted to be normal. And when she became normal, he became normal. And then it was very nice. So that is the one aspect. The same time is, Prabhupada says, our women are not ordinary women. Means that they're not just women who fully identify as women, like that. They know that they're devotees, but they have a feminine body. So that has to be addressed. Means an intelligent woman knows she's in a woman's body and acts according to that. An unintelligent woman means she's in a woman's body and says there's no difference and, you know, she's as good as the men. That's called a woman who's very attached to her material body and identifying as a woman. Right? Because the whole basis of being in a position, like being a GBC or giving the class or giving the lecture, is just based on that she's a woman, right? Like now, we didn't make all these GBCs, the men GBCs, because they were a man. Okay, oh, you're a man. You seem to be a man. You got a beard. Okay, GBC. Like that. That's not how it works. It works on the principle of qualification. So if we identify so strongly with our body, and therefore then want to act out of culture, then we end up with philosophy, or not this body, Prabhu, without religion. And that's called mental speculation. And we see it doesn't create a conducive, natural, peaceful atmosphere. So we have to see that we are in this woman's body, we have to act like it. Just like Prabhupada is in a man's body, he just acted like one. But we see, very gentle, very kind and all that, but he never transgressed that he was a man. He was a sannyasi. He never let women do personal service. He never let them come and do so many things. He was a sannyasi. So he followed that very strictly. Lord Chaitanya also. He followed very strictly. Haridas, Choto Haridas, he was just going out begging. And he was just talking with is it Malini? She was like in her, you know, oldest, 60s years old. He was like 20s, you know? But Lord Chaitanya rejected him because as a man, as a sannyasi, as a beggar, you're not supposed to look at the face of these women. You're supposed to look down. You go to the door, and when the door opens, you keep your head down, and you go, Bhavati Bhiksham Dehi. And that's it. You don't look up at him, talk to him, and this and that, and talk, I want some rice for Lord Chaitanya. I heard you have some good rice. You know? Like that. So therefore, Lord Chaitanya rejected him. So we understand what position we're in, then figure out what's the best way to engage that in Krishna's service. Does that make some sense? So therefore, because our women aren't ordinary, is because they can understand they're not the body, but at the same time be able to act within that culture. Right? So also, by studying the philosophy, by discussing with the other ladies, you know, hearing the classes, performing devotional service, we can also develop those qualities. So it's not just that one has to have very strong man. One can also, on one's own, develop so much of those qualities, or gain so much. Because originally, all those qualities of chastity, this and that, came from the mother. The mother would train one in chastity and all these things. I've mentioned many times, as I've seen in... I saw an example in one Brahmin family. The child was 3 years old, a girl, but she'd do something culturally improper. And the mother would say, a chaste girl won't do this. You know? Because they're already training from chastity at that age. They don't know what chastity... No, they won't tell them chastity means, you know, that you're fixed your mind on one man, this, that. They don't tell them that. They just make it, drill it into the girl's head that chastity and being a good girl are synonymous. So it's totally, rooted in the heart of that girl. Then when she hits puberty and she hears about chastity, the other meaning has immediate effect. Just like that. It's just realization on the spot. But the training has already been going on 9 years before that. You know, in proper behavior, all those different things. So that's all taught by the mother. But of course, in that scenario, then you have the father who is then supporting the mother so she can do all that. So both elements are there. Strong man can have a lot of influence or awaken that, but at the same time is then we must take advantage and gain that from the other women. So other women and that we find with those qualities, we should associate with them, try to gain them's qualities, ask, inquire, you know, whatever it takes. Read the philosophy. Because ultimately, both the husband and the wife have to give up the identification with the body and make that commitment to totally surrender to Krishna. So the whole idea is we have an attachment to this illusion, we have a conditioning to this illusion, so there is a process that you can go through that attachment and that illusion to remove the illusion. And if we do it in the traditional way, the proper way, then we'll find it's very pleasant and very nice, if it's done right. The men act nicely, properly give the protection, they deal in a pleasant way, the women take their part, they deal in their proper ways, then it's very gentle and very nice. But if we become all weird, bent out of shape, we misunderstand, you know, we become militant, all these things, then it's a big problem. One thing that may go back on this, that was a point before, we didn't bring out, because we started on this point, the class today, on the meaning of less intelligent. This is very important to understand. So we've discussed what we meant here. So in the Vedic literature, then intelligence means to discriminate between matter and spirit, right? In the Bhagavatam, they don't say someone's very intelligent because he could memorize all the timetables, you know, or they can memorize pi to the 100th decibel, or, you know, that they know the whole Encyclopedia Britannica by heart, or that one is so expert that one can, you know, manage a flourishing business empire all over the planet. None of these are counted as intelligent. You know? So memory, material knowledge, even material discrimination. One is very experienced, expert, knows what to do in this thing, you know. That's not considered intelligence. Intelligence means being able to discriminate between matter and spirit and pick the spirit. Right? You know, Krishna says, what is matter, what is spirit, what is the relationship between them? That is knowledge. That's real intelligence. So therefore we see, with proper training, the man has the better ability to make that decision. And the woman has a weakness, slight weakness on that, simply that one point only. So if it says less intelligent, it means that point. So it's very important that that's what's understood. Therefore, the men shouldn't just say, well, the women are stupid. Less intelligent, the Bhagavatam doesn't classify as stupid. That's what we learn in school. In our Western academic education, intelligence is memory and knowledge. Basically, it boils down to memory, and then if we can apply it. This is not what the Bhagavatam's talking about. As we see, you know, all around us, ladies are doing so many things, very intelligent, and all that, and are doing very nicely. So that's not what it's talking about. Right? So this whole thing of the men just writing off the women as less intelligent, that is not proper. The whole thing is if there's some difficulty, that protection has to be there so that the proper decisions can be made, the proper conclusions can be come to. So if the women are upset, it's because the men are thinking that they're stupid and don't deal with them properly and don't give shelter. So therefore, if there's any problems, it goes back to the men not behaving properly, not doing their duties. Therefore, the women are upset and feel that they need to take care of themselves. You know, like that. So it goes back to there. Then other aspect is the women themselves can't also take this. Well, it says in the Bhagavatam, women are less stupid, less intelligent. So therefore, I don't want to associate with women because they're less intelligent, so I'll always try to be with the men. That aspect is also there. So one should understand that there's great valuable lessons and association and experience that can be shared amongst the women. And by doing that, that is very important to also create a proper emotional feelings and support that is necessary. Otherwise, we see nowadays so many. The grihasthas, they never associate with each other. Women, they come for a little chit-chat and that's it. But seriously, they don't associate like that. They don't actually have good, solid Krishna-conscious association. So that has to be... Yes?
But he's there too long and he gets a fever and it becomes typhoid and it's anxiety completely with his mother. And the doctors come and of course his understanding is that he has to have soup and it's chicken soup. So the mother's so attached to Bai that completely surrendered to what the doctor is saying. And she's coming to the husband and pleading desperately, you have to do this. And of course she's the chaste wife. She's properly situated. And the husband is drawing on that emotion and takes his decision emotional scene and it's very desperate. He accepts that he's out the door and he's pacing backwards and forwards, and you can see that a boy's being forced or wants to take this chicken soup, and he's pushing backwards and forwards and trying relentlessly not to have it in his mouth. And his mother's, "Oh, boy, you must. Come, boy, you must take." And in the scene in the back, and the father's pacing backwards and forwards, and to the point he has to stop, you know. Puts his intelligence in rein and he picks up a boy and takes him in front of the deities. And the mother's a little bit perplexed, but at the same time she's taking guidance from the husband and sees, yes, this is the only opportunity we have, is actually to surrender to Krishna, and they're there all night. And they don't know the result, whether a boy's going to live or die, they're just there praying to Krishna. And of course, my understanding of seeing that and listening to your lectures also just manifested so intensely that for the woman, because she does get eluded by the emotions and the intelligence isn't the most thing in the foreground, she has to have that protection.
Yeah.
And that's where Shastra says, you know, the father first, the husband, and then the son.
Yeah.
So to be eluded, think that we don't have to have that protection, is completely having no understanding of who you are, what you are in relationship to your responsibility. And I've been wanting to say that to you for a long time.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's a very apt situation.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Did you, everyone could hear that? Huh? Yeah, so this is very nice. The one will be, it's also important to see that in the scriptures, that when the nature, you know, the actual internal nature of the women is being described, we will see it is never being described by the men. You look at the chapters where real nitty-gritty is being described, you'll always see that it is women who describe it. And the reason for this is that if the man describes it, one, he has to hear it from the ladies anyway. But someone will say, well, they don't know. Or they're biased and making it up. So in the scripture then, it always is one of the ladies will give that. Because then they're speaking from the heart. Because they know the nature, they know these things. So we see that many of these things, Urvasi speaks then in the 11th canto. Ook speaks. Starts with a P. She's a society girl. Pingala speaks. Then in the I think it's in the Skanda. No, Shiva Puran, Linga Puran. What's her name? Parvati. She speaks. And then there's one other one where then Narad Muni, he's going somewhere, and Rumba Devi. She's also one of the famous society girls, along with Urvasi. She happens to be passing the other way, and he just stops her for a moment and says, "May I ask you a question?" So then, you know, she says, "Well, why would you want to ask me a question?" You know, says, "No, just I had some question, and you know, I just wanted to know." And so she says, "Well, as long as it's something I can answer," and I says, "I wouldn't ask you a question you can't answer." So she agrees. Then he asks, "Well, can you kindly speak on the nature of women?" So then she says, "Well, if I speak, wouldn't that be improper? You know, because then it may, you know, other ladies may feel bad, or, you know, you're supposed to, you know, protect one's own, you know, one doesn't, you know, one should not be a traitor." So he says, "No, we're just talking about truth. We're not talking about speaking anything otherwise." So then she says a few things just on the nature. And then, you know, after some basic principles have been said, then he says thank you and goes. So it's very, very important is that we see in the family training that in the house, then the mother then will be giving, you know, be very compassionate and very, how you say, protective of the son, like that. But and with the daughter, she will be the disciplinarian. She will very nicely be strict with the daughter to train her in everything she knows. And it's the and the we'll see the opposite for the daughter. The father will be the one that's very compassionate, very loving, and all that. And excuse me, that's what I just said. No, yeah, and he'll be very strict with the son because it's like that. So one learns about the qualities of the women from the women, the qualities of the men from the men, like that. And then from the scriptures and from, you know, others, we learn how to make it work, how to interface that whole relationship. Then it works very, very nicely. So this is very important that without the one needs, like on the social level, the emotional level, the women need to be able to hear and associate from each other and get this kind of direction. Like that, those who are more senior can guide the others. This is very important that the junior women look up to the senior women for guidance in this. Same with the brahmacharis. The juniors will look up to the senior men. Doesn't matter if they're brahmacharis, sannyasis, vanaprastas, grihastas, they can tell. The same time is then we should be able to listen to either party if they can give good direction. I've heard some of the, you know, how you say, some of the best brahmachari classes from married women. You know, I've seen a couple of cases where there was, you know, some brahmachari who was a good brahmachari and was thinking to get married, wasn't sure because, you know, everybody's saying this, that, it's all proper. And some married women heard about this, right? So then they went to speak, you know? Means that someone who needs to get married, they should get married. But someone is yourself, why you should get married. And then they would give the whole rundown, why not to get married? What is the problems in the whole house? So like this, we can learn so many things. We have to be open to learning that from others. We cannot be biased. Like that. It's very, that's very important. The devotee is very, is not, in this way, is very open. Swan, Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes two kinds of devotees, the swan-like and the ass-like. So the swan-like means they're very broad-minded, very gentle. The ass-like means one who is very sectarian. You know, they have their own group, they can only associate there. They don't appreciate anybody else. They have their own opinion. That's it. Like that. So, you know, natural recommendation that the Bhagavatam is meant for swan-like men. Right? So, you know, Bhagavatam mentions crow-like. Yes, of course. Crow-like is for the materialists. But within the category of devotees, we have swan-like and ass-like. So we should avoid this. We should be able to take knowledge. A Brahmin is respected for knowledge, right? And we see in the Vedic culture, anyone who has experience, because that comes by age and endeavor, activity, that is also respected. So anybody who can give us some understanding, give us some realization, that must be accepted, that must be respected. And then things work very, very nicely. Then we can have a very good, reciprocation between devotees. Devotees are looking for some kind of reciprocation, some kind of feeling of belonging, right? You don't leave the material world unless you want to feel that you're belonging to, you know, the spiritual world. So that means then we want belonging to spiritual culture, spiritual relationships. So we have to base that. So therefore, religion is there to give the foundation on which the relationship is there, to see that it will not become mundane, but will maintain its spiritual purity. Right? Right? Just like if you take a boy and a girl and put them together, there's every chance that they will leave. You may sit them down to talk about Bhagavatam, but there's every possibility it will leave that platform and fall down to a lower platform. Right? Either mundane emotion or or sense gratification. Very, you know, very almost predictable. Therefore, the Vedic literatures give these ideas how to situate everybody so they can do what they want to do in their time, but not somewhere else. Right? Like business. You want to do business, you do business. Get right into business. But when you come to the temple and attend the programs, leave your business outside. Right? Now we are devotees. And so we see things there. We don't see things by profit and lot, what I'll gain. You know, well, if I lead the kirtan, then I'll get some respect in that. Or if I lead the kirtan because there's some people who are better at the kirtan, they'll think bad about me, so I'll lose. So, no, we don't. So the idea is everything, we have a conditioned nature, we take care of it. But we take care of it in a situation in which it will be utilized without giving disturbance. Therefore, the request of the scriptures is look at your position very realistically and then understand what is the situation in which one can best engage oneself in Krishna's service to the greatest advantage. Okay, 59. I'll have to stop here. You know, I would go on, but I'm supposed to today address the social development seminar like that. I had agreed to one day, so this is the day. So it's supposed to be at 12, and my clock says 12, but I think it's fast. Huh? Okay, thank you very much. Sorry. Well, tomorrow we'll try to continue with, like, you know, if there's practical questions or things like that, just on application, and we'll see what we can do. Because tomorrow's, I think, last day, no? Yeah. Okay, Jai. Thank you. Hare Krishna, Jai. Srila Prabhupada ki Jai. Jai.